I'm Jana Marin, and you're listening to Season 2 of More to the Story, the podcast that's all about creative nonfiction and the power of sharing your personal story.
Tell me a story. Tell me true. I want to know what happened to you. The stars are all out and the night is so blue. Tell me a story and I'll tell mine to you.
Welcome to Season 2, Episode number 9 of More to the Story, a show that is all about something near and dear to my heart, telling true stories and sharing them with the world. In addition to this podcast, I also publish a literary magazine called Under the Gum Tree, which is dedicated to creative nonfiction and visual art. The magazine is published quarterly in digital and print. If you enjoy the readings on this show, I encourage you to check out the complete stories by purchasing a single issue or getting a subscription. Your purchase directly supports the work of the writers and artists we publish. Digital subscriptions are $2 a month and print subscriptions are $7 a month. All that info is online at underthegumtree.com. On today's episode of More to the Story, I'm joined by Ira Sukrungrung, one of Under the Gum Tree's previous contributors. Ira is the author of The Melting Season, Southside Buddhist, Talk Thai, and In Thailand It Is Night. He teaches in the MFA program at University of South Florida, and his essay, The Animatronic Dog, appears in the April 2016 issue of Under the Gum Tree. Before we get to the interview, here is Ira reading an excerpt from his essay, Monsters.
Meditation on monsters. When I was 6, I visited Thailand and made my cousin Ant draw me monsters. He was a far superior artist, and all he wanted to do was to please his American cousin. He sketched pages and pages of monsters, filling my notebook with Frankenstein and Dracula, werewolves and mummies. After a few days of constant drawing, he said in Thai, "Would you like me to draw Buddha? I'm good at drawing Buddha." I shook my head. Buddha didn't howl at the moon. Buddha didn't drink blood. Buddha was not constructed by decaying body parts. Buddha was boring. "You know, these things don't exist," he said. He was 3 years older, skinny like the bamboo stalks outside, had dimples so deep they could swallow fingers. "But they do," I said. "In America, they are everywhere." I knew a woman once who was afraid of everything. How she hid from sight when the doorbell rang. How she never spoke a word to strangers and refused to meet eyes. How she did not venture into the world except to go to work. "There are too many monsters out there," she said. And so she raised her son in the same way, to fear the unknown, to beware of anyone in America, because America was a place where bad things happened. America kidnapped children. America beat elderly men. America murdered unsuspecting women. This woman, despite her fear, watched the daily news with puckered lips and a shaking head. She relished the news, which fed her fear. When her son asked her why she surrounded herself with all the wrongs of the world, she said, "It's better to see, better to know what hurts you." The first monster I met was Dave Colwell, a.k.a. Dak, a Southside terror. Dak was a few years older than me, and he had the habit of roaming the Chicago streets in his dirty jeans and jean jacket. He wasn't big, but beefy, hands like sledgehammers, face riddled with acne. He picked at his face, so there were large scabs and bloody raw spots on his cheeks and chin, like someone who had leprosy. Schoolyard rumors circulated about him. Dak threw third graders into car windows for fun. Dak mauled someone's face until it was mincemeat. Dak set a cat on fire. Of course I feared Dak. Of course, seeing him coming down the street that afternoon as I was walking back from school put dread in my steps. The city block seemed infinite and dark and unnaturally silent. I kept my head down, stared hard at the tufted grass poking out of the cracks of the sidewalk, I thought if I kept my head down, my shoulders hunched, I could disappear. I could be like the cars parked in driveways, the trim bushes, the mailboxes. I could be a thing. But I wasn't a thing because I breathed and my breath was loud and my heart thumped fast and I sweated despite the cool autumn day. Dak's footsteps got louder and louder on the black top, the scrape of his gym shoes, the slight drag of his untied laces. I told myself not to look up. Yo, I kept walking. Yo, kid. I turned my eyes toward Dak. I think I might have been tearing up. Yo. You know what time it is? Time for me to get my ass kicked. Time for me to be thrown into a car window, this car window, an Oldsmobile station wagon with wood siding. Time for me to be part of this growing legend of Dak, part of a story that started with, dude, once Dak took this Asian kid. Yo, Dak said. I looked at my watch. I told him the time. My voice a hushed squeal. Thanks, kid. He kept walking. Why tell this story if I wasn't going to be pummeled? Why bring you to the brink of danger and not deliver? Because monsters, real monsters, aren't monsters all the time. Because monsters, real monsters, are more complicated than we give them credit for. That monsters, real monsters, like Dak, come from hard families. That they are beaten down by their fathers, that they live in small mobile homes with rusted out holes on the side covered in plastic, that they are stripped of all that is beautiful in the world, that monsters, real monsters, sometimes just want to know the time. So that was just like the first like three sections of the essay.
Sure. Thanks, Ira, and welcome to More to the Story.
Oh, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
I wanted to start with your writing background and how you came to writing creative nonfiction, and then we can talk a little bit about the essay.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So I've always written, you know, since I was a child. I was always a reader. My mom would complain to her friends that I just, books are overflowing the house. But when I got to college, I didn't think being a writer was something I could do until I took a few fiction courses. I started writing really terrible fiction, like really god-awful fiction. And I was 19. I was really cocky. And I thought I would say something. I would write these letters to The New Yorker when I sent them a piece. I would say, like, when you publish my story, please use my pseudonym, right? Please use my pseudonym, Pierce Tan. And I had the pseudonym because Amy Tan was the only writer, Asian American writer I knew at the time, and Pierce because my stories would pierce your soul.
Oh my gosh, I love it.
it was ridiculous. And then I had a teacher, his name was Kent Harif. He wrote this amazing, amazing novel, Plain Song, which is probably one of my favorite books of all time. And he said that I should take a creative nonfiction course with Lisa Knopp. And that changed everything. I think for me, taking the creative nonfiction course made me start evaluating and excavating the things I've always wondered about my own life. Things that I had questions about, you know, like what it means to be an immigrant son, why my mother was so unhappy living in America for the last 36 years, you know, why my father had this wayward nature of his, why he was such a dreamer. And I think, so I did that for like 5 years, just kind of interrogating myself. And so what happened is, like, once you begin to interrogate yourself, you can start interrogating the world you find yourself in. And so when I returned to fiction, like 5 years later, when I started writing poetry, suddenly I felt like I knew, not that I knew the world, but I knew something about the world. And it was because I actually had to look into myself.
I love that. And so many writers who I talk to about nonfiction have similar experiences where they say, well, I first started writing really crappy fiction.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, so talk a little bit about, as a writer now, you do write fiction, poetry, and nonfiction. So how do you shift between the three genres? Are you ever writing all three at the same time, or do you have to kind of like isolate and dedicate yourself to one genre while you're working on a project until you can shift gears for the other genres?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think my own process is that I never try to write multiple genres at one time. If I'm working on a poem, it's just that poem. If I'm working on a short story, it's just that short story. If I'm working on nonfiction, it's just that piece. And even though I think, to me, the genres are very amoebic, you know, and I think they kind of overlap each other. That's why I think I find such a thrill in writing in all three genres. The mind space that each genre occupies for me is completely different, right? When I write poetry, I'm trying to really distill language. I'm trying to understand language, right? Jane Hirschfeld wrote something about like every time a poet goes to the poem, she is creating a new world of language, right? And so that's where I go to poetry for, where I'm trying to create this new world of language, right? When I write nonfiction, I want to tell my story. That pronoun I is so powerful. You know, it's a pronoun that claims, right? And so when I wrote, I had this question a lot with my first book, Talk Thai. People would ask, why didn't you just publish it as a novel? It reads like a novel. And my answer is always, I didn't want it to be fiction because I want it to be about my life and my family's life and my family's life in Chicago, right? And I want it to be about the Thai immigrant experience, not the generic immigrant experience. The Thai immigrant experience is a very different story, right? And so it was I wanted to talk about these larger issues that surrounded my life during that time period. In fiction, it's funny. I think I go to fiction to have no narrative responsibility, which means in nonfiction, I can, you know, if I'm cruel in my work, if I'm cruel to another character, the writer at the desk has to claim some sort of responsibility for that cruelty. In fiction, you create a character, and they can be as cruel, as short-sighted, as flawed as they want, right? But there's no responsibility for that character, right? I think it's interesting. My newest book that came out last year was called The Melting Season. It was a short story collection. And I still think it's one of the truest things I've ever written. I wrote it during a really dark time in my life. I wrote when I was going through a divorce, when I was going through depression. And a lot of the stories, though, they're completely made up. The plot is like made up, right? It's set in places I've never been. The sentiments, the emotions of those stories were really as close to the bone as what I was feeling during that time. So there's something, you know, there's something freeing about writing fiction for me, where I can just, you know, if I'm in a really bad mood, I can just let my character take that mood and run with it.
I love that distinction. I think that's a really great way to frame it. The I is claiming and the fiction is no responsibility. That's such a really succinct way to define the difference between why you would choose one genre versus the other. People often ask me, well, why wouldn't you just write your stories, autobiographical stories, as fiction? And I think for me, that is exactly the reason, because part of this, the power of telling those stories is that I am claiming them. And I'm saying, here's me, here's my story. Learn and understand from what I can share.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think readers turn to the genres differently too. I think we have, as nonfiction writers, we do talk about our flaws, right? We try to make sense of our flaws. And readers get to be in our head, on our shoulders, as we're trying to think these things through. In fiction, readers actually detect the flaw. Like they input, you know, the reasoning behind why this character is doing what they're doing. They're there. They're like, oh, don't do that, even though they know what's going to happen, right? So there's a different kind of reading vantage that for me, at least in my own kind of work, I think I feel readers will have when they come to reading my fiction or my nonfiction.
Right, right. Well, let's talk about the essay you read the excerpt from. Talk a little bit about how that piece came together for you. What was the impetus for you to write about monsters?
It's funny. So I was asked to be part of this conference in New Orleans, and I was asked to be part of a panel called Monsters. And one of the things I'm thinking about doing, I just finished another draft of a nonfiction book. So I'm starting a fiction, another short story collection about ghost stories and monsters, actually. I've always been fascinated with that. My family has always been fascinated about ghosts and monsters. And so I used this panel to really explore the meaning of the word monster, right? And it's funny, like, my mother used to watch horror movies obsessively. She loved watching them. She watched them like comedies, though. She would just start laughing, like The Shining. She thinks is the funniest movie in the world, which I always find like really troubling. But she was so afraid of the world. Like, to her, the monsters on these movies were not real. The real fears were the monsters that lurked in her everyday life, right? And I think I wanted to kind of talk about that, or talk about where monsters come from, or how we create monsters, and really kind of get to the source word of, you know, what it is that we really fear, right? What it is that we try to hide from. And so that's, I think, the jumping off point for this meditation on monsters. Mm.
Do you think you internalize some of that same reaction yourself from the way your mom was seeing monsters in the world? Because I was getting that from the piece a little bit. You weren't so afraid of the of the vampires and the werewolves. No. But you were more afraid of the bully at school.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I definitely picked that up from her. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid growing up, I mean, it was the only things I read were things by Stephen King or Peter Straub, all these classic horror, Clive Barker, right? And I just read them voraciously. I had no fear of them, right? But when I went outside the realms of my room, right, when I went to school, especially in those early years, there were more fears out there for me than any book about severed heads or a killer car or a killer clown could ever do, right? And so, yeah, I definitely inherited that. And now, you know, I'm a father to a one-year-old, and this idea of monsters and what it is outside this world, it has even more meaning for me, has even more fear for me, you know, raising a son in this kind of world where it seems like we are in a very dangerous and scary time. Mm.
I don't want to give the end of the essay away because I loved the image that you end with. So I'll just say, as soon as it's published, let me know so that I can share it and refer back to this conversation, because you do circle back to the drawings from your cousin at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Will you talk a little bit about how crafting an essay like that comes together for you? Because it's what I would call a segmented essay, where you have sections that aren't necessarily leading from one to the next in a narrative form, but they are all related. And one of the things that I see writers struggle with is, how do you decide what to include, what not to include? How do you decide the final sequence of the sections? So would you talk a little bit about that process?
Absolutely. I think there's so much freedom in that first draft of writing a segmented essay. What I love about the lyric essay, what I love about the segmented essay, is that you sometimes go in with a plan, but that plan always gets diverted, right? In that you write one section, and that white space between that tiny white space between each section allows you to go into it. I call it the interdimensional portal. You go into it, and then you don't know where you're gonna be, right? You could be in a different area, you can be in a different voice, a different POV. And I love that because it always keeps me on the edge of my seats as I'm writing it. And I also think it keeps readers on their edge of their seats too. Where is he gonna go next? You know, when we go to the next section, where are we gonna be, right? What kind of voice is gonna lead us? So I think with A Meditation on Monsters, I really did take it literally. It became a meditation. I wanted to see all the areas, all the ways I can think about monsters. So the original draft of it was much, much longer. It was about, I'd say, 20 pages, right? And then what I did was I started paring back. I started seeing which sections repeated themselves, right? And then I eventually had it down to 10 pages. But then the next step with the segmented essay is that how do you put each section together, right? And this is what I love. This is why I always try to tell my students. When you're writing a lyric essay, when you're writing a fragmented essay, you actually think more as a visual artist than you actually do as a writer, right? Because you're looking at how each section is playing off of each other, right? I love when I see lyric essays that have large sections. The section I read about DAC is a large section in the piece, and the next section that follows it is really short in a different tone completely, right? Visually, I take that in. Like, as a reader, I take that in. There's something exciting about that. So you're really kind of like manipulating, you know, and you're making it see, okay, what if I did put this over here and put this over here? And so in many ways, it is like creating a collage, right? Whereas when we back away from the whole piece, we get the whole picture. Right. But if we zero in on one section, yes, it has meaning, but it doesn't have the overall meaning. And so it really gets us out of our idea that we always have to control where the narrative is going. Right. Because when you have a fragmented story, you don't have a cohesive narrative line anymore. Right. And so you have to think in more creative and more visual ways.
Mm. That's a really great way of looking at it that I hadn't thought. I guess I'm aware of it as a reader when I experience a piece in that way, but I hadn't applied that as a writer, you know? So what do you do with the 10 pages that you cut from that essay?
I have a file called Set Aside, right? And it has... Man, I have a lot of files called Set Aside, but some of the files are 100, 200 pages long, right? And in the past, I've actually made lyric essays from those files, right? Or if I want to write something, but I don't know what to write, I would visit that file and see, you know, a section that I had cut and like, oh, you know, I can reframe this piece now. I have another way of doing this piece. So I never get rid of anything I write. I keep it so that maybe I can reuse them in another piece.
I have a similar file called cuts that yep. I do the same thing. It gets cut. Okay. It goes in the cut folder, but I'm not deleting it. I'm not throwing it away.
No, absolutely. Never, yeah. Never throw it. Never.
Yeah. So I wanted to also ask you about your work as an editor, because I'm also an editor, and I'm constantly torn between the two roles of writing and editing when it comes to my own work. It's hard for me to shut off the editor brain.
Right.
So right. Talk a little bit about that for you and how your role as an editor may or may not affect your work as a writer.
I think I'm going to talk about process a little bit. For me, my process is that usually my best writing time is earlier in the morning, when I wake up. Right, I do a lot of my first drafts, a lot of my writing during those morning hours. I do a lot of my revision. I do a lot of my editorial work in the evening, and I think it's because, just on a very simplistic level, when I just wake up, I'm not really awake yet, You know, I'm still like not there. I think one of the things that all writers battle is the little devil on their shoulder, right? That devil is still sleeping when I'm writing that first draft, right? But I want that devil to be there when I revise. I want that devil to say, this is not really working, or I think you should cut this, or I think you should rewrite this sentence and make it one long sentence instead of four short sentences, right? We need that devil, right? So that's why most of my editorial work happens later in the day. So I do think too, when we wake up, especially there's something freeing, there's something like mystical about first waking up. You're half in a dream world, you're half in the awake world, and there's something that's happening on the page that you really don't know. You're just letting it go. You're just letting it happen. And I think one of my teachers, Kent Harris, said there's something special about that thought that we have no control over that happens on the page, right? This is also the reason why you never want to cut or get rid of or delete everything, because right. If you cut that originality, you cut that urgent line or paragraph that could be used elsewhere. So a lot of my editing does come in the end. And, you know, my roles as an editor and writer are, I try to separate them it's hard, but I never, if I'm working on the magazine, if I'm working on Sweet, I never edit Sweet when I'm in a bad mood, right? I never edit Sweet after I've graded, you know, papers. I don't edit Sweet after I've read 300 pages of a thesis. I always edit Sweet when I'm in a good mood. And the reason I do that is because I don't want to carry any kind of anger or whatever I'm feeling into and having that be the lens where I'm looking at other people's work. Right. And this where being also a writer, you know how hard they worked on these things. You know how much time they took on it. And it's only fair that you are put in the mood. You should be in the mood to look at that with a kind of lens of generosity, right? And surprise, right? It's easy to be jaded. It's easy as an editor to think, and it's easy to say everything is not working, right? I know editors who say that. I think it's harder. I think the good editor sees promise in everything. They just can't take it. You know, they don't have the time to work with them. And so that's how I approach my editing job. I always try to see what the writer's trying to do. And I try to look at it from a clear point of view and not be clouded by whatever's going on in my life. So yeah, I read essays during that time. And I try not to read more than, I would say, 10 a day. Right. Because after 10, it becomes like work. And the reason I created Sweet was not because of work. It's because it was my way of giving back to this literary community. Right. I wanted it to be fun. That's why I've never had Sweet affiliated with a university. Because as soon as it's affiliated with a university, it becomes something else. Right. Sweet started as a love for literature, a love for nonfiction and poetry, and that conversation between the two. And so I always want to approach it with that clear headedness that it deserves.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Share a little bit more about Sweet as a publication. It's online, and what kind of work do you publish there?
Okay. So Sweet is in its beginning is 10th year.
Congratulations.
Yeah. We've been around for a long time. And it started off as just three friends, me and Casey Wolf and Katie Regal, just sitting in an apartment in Columbus, Ohio, talking about wanting to start a literary magazine. I've always been obsessed with literary magazines. You know, I had wonderful mentors at Southern Illinois University, John Tribble and Allison Joseph, who taught me there were more things out there other than The New Yorker to send to, right? And they showed me all these magazines that were out there, and I just kind of fell in love with it. You know, I fell in love with the journal. I loved how they looked. I loved how they felt in your hands. They weren't like the magazines you saw at 7-Eleven or at bookstores. There was something substantial, right? And I love flipping the page and seeing, like, you know, Yusef Komunyakaa, a Pulitzer Prize winning poet with a first poet, right? First time published poet next. I love seeing those things. And so it's always been a dream for me to start a magazine. So we decided to do Sweet, and we decided to do publish only nonfiction and poetry. And the reason for that is not because we don't like fiction, is that we were tired of the conversation about between nonfiction and fiction. And it's all because of the backlash of James Frey and A Million Little Pieces, and, you know, and it seemed like the discussion was no longer a discussion. It was more like a yes or no question. Did you lie? Yes. Did you lie? No. And that's it, right? Where I thought, to me, there was more conversation and more bridges between poetry and nonfiction. I believe that a poet and an essayist share the same kind of brain, right? Where a poem comes from and where an essay comes from, to me, comes from the same part, at least in my own kind of process. So we wanted to kind of open up the dialogue between these two genres. And as for what we publish at Sweet, we've published chronological memoirs, we published lyric essays, we published really experimental work, we've published some literary journalism, right? So, and I think it's because I'm not a writer who's wedded to any subgenre, right? Like, so I write memoir, I write personal essay, I write lyric, I write nature, I write travel. That's part of the thrill of being a writer, by the way. It's just kind of like always being a student to it, always trying new things. And so that's how the aesthetic, at least for the nonfiction, I do mostly the nonfiction part of it. Katie does the poetry, but in the nonfiction, I'm not looking for one type of essay. I'm looking for something that is more about what gets at me. If I go to bed and I wake up with a line still in my head, I know that I should go revisit that piece. I try not to accept an essay right away. I sleep on it. And if it's still there, still rings in my head, that's when I know it's something worth taking.
Mm-hmm. And where can people find out more about the publication?
So it's sweetlit.com, sweetlit.com. We also do homemade chapbooks. So we do an online journal, then we do homemade hand-stitched chapbooks of poetry and nonfiction. Usually the authors we choose for that are authors who appeared in Sweet a few times and don't have books. We feel like we want to be in service of those who haven't published a collection yet of some sort. And so it's a labor of love. I have wonderful grad students. My wife is a wonderful artist. And so we would sit down, we all read the book, and we decide on a approach and how to do it, right? You know, what art goes into it. And it's really beautiful. And our idea is, I think people are more willing to buy art than they are books right now. So why not make artistic books?
Mm. That speaks to me, because Under the Gum Tree is all about combining the art and the literature. Absolutely. The visual is so important, I think. What are you working on now? What new projects do you have in the works?
I am a writer who has a lot of things going.
Yes, I can tell.
My newest book is coming out in the spring, called Buddha's Dog, and that's where Meditation on Monsters will be appearing. And that's a collection essay. The first half is about a life with dogs and how dogs really changed my life in the way of being in the world, right? And then the second half of it is these meditations. I have a meditation on monsters, I have a meditation on time, I have a meditation on the body, right? And so it's another collection of essays. I just finished a draft of a memoir that's set in Thailand, but the real story is the year of the divorce. I'd been married for, you know, 12 years, known this woman who's still my best friend for 15 years and married young. So I realized that when we broke up, I realized I didn't know what I wanted because everything I wanted was what she wanted, right? You know, everything, you know, I liked was what she liked. So I found myself, you know, at the age of, you know, 37, going like, who am I? Like, what is it that I want? What it is that I like? So that's a memoir about that year, of kind of trying to find myself and the various dumb decisions I've made in doing that. And then I'm also working on a memoir about my time as a monk. I was a monk in Thailand, about 8 years ago. All Thai men, have to be monks at some point in their lives for their family. And so I decided to be a monk, for my mom, and I did it because one, I did it for her, of course. She's been wanting me to do it for a long time. But I think for me, Buddhism has always been about family. And I wanted to find out what Buddhism was separate from family, right? And I thought, well, being a monk will get me there. And I think the hardest thing about it was after my time as a monk was over, I actually had more questions than I had answered. So it took me another 4 or 5 years to like sit down with it and start writing it because everything was a whirl, right? So that's a book that is something I'm working on. And the other one I just started was I think I told you, a short story collection about ghosts and monsters, but grounded in what our world is right now. Like for example, one of the stories is about people disappearing. But on an NPR, I was listening to NPR and someone said, if poor people disappeared, no one would notice. So the story is about people disappearing, but the people who are disappearing, the poor people, people of color. And so they're ghost stories, they're supernatural stories, but they're grounded in something in our culture, mm-hmm. our political climate, our social climate right now. So that's actually kind of fun because I've been doing a lot of research about paranormal and all that stuff too, which is great. And I'm, you know, I have this ongoing poetry collection. You know, I write a poem maybe once or twice a year and then hopefully, you know, in 5 years I'll have enough for another book. So that's there too.
Oh my gosh. So many good things it sounds like coming down the pike for you.
Absolutely.
So the book that's coming out in the spring is, say that title again.
Buddha's Dog. Other Meditations. Yeah.
Okay. And are any of the other memoirs scheduled for publication?
Well, we'll see. I just turned in that draft of the memoir in Thailand. It's called The Time Between. And so hopefully that's going to come out, you know, a year after Buddha's Dog. But, you know, that book was the hardest book I've ever written, and I want to get everything right in it. So I want to find the right place. I want to find the right, you know, editor for it. I want to find everything that would be perfect for that book.
Well, we'll be keeping our eye out for it. It sounds like it'll be really a great read. Thank you for sharing your work with us today and some of your experience. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Where can people find out more about you and your work online?
I would go to my website, which is simple, buddhistboy.com.
Great. We'll include that link in the show notes of this episode. And the titles of your work and all of that good stuff so people can know what to look for. And thanks again for being on the show today. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun.
That was Ira Suk Rung Rung. Visit him online at buddhistboy.com. Follow him on Twitter at Suk Rung Rung. Find all of those links and the correct spelling of Ira's last name in the show notes for the episode at moretothestorypodcast.com. If you're interested in creative nonfiction as a genre, don't forget about my audio course, CNF 101. You can check it out and sign up online from my website at janamarlise.com/CNF101 course. It's a 6-week email course, which means when you sign up, you'll get a lesson emailed to you with the audio once a week for 6 weeks. Those emails include, of course, the audio, which you can download and listen to at any time and as many times as you like, reading material, summary of the lesson, as well as homework for the week. In 6 weeks, you understand how the literary world works and talks about the genre. You'll read examples of the genre in all of its different forms. You'll practice writing in each of the subgenres of creative nonfiction. You'll have access to the materials for future reference, continued access to a Facebook group, private Facebook group with other course participants, and of course, you'll become familiar with many other resources available for continuing to explore creative nonfiction. Check it out at janamarlise.com/CNF101course. I hope you'll join me. I would love nothing more than to support you in your writing journey of telling your true story. Next time on More to the Story, I talk with Carol Marsh about her time as the founding executive director of a residence in Washington, D.C. for homeless women living with AIDS and the memoir that she wrote about that time in her life. To subscribe to this podcast, go to iTunes.com/moretothestory. And while you're there, leave a review. I love feedback, I love hearing from you, and it helps with the ratings. More to the Story is produced out of my home office in Sacramento, California, with technical and audio support from TJ Santoro. Special thanks to my husband, Jeremy Marin, who wrote and performed the theme song. You can visit us online at moretothestorypodcast.com, follow Under the Gumtree on Twitter and Instagram at @UnderGumtree. I'm Jana Marlise Marin, just Jana on Twitter, Jana Marlise everywhere else. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you soon on the next episode of More to the Story.
Tell me a story. Tell me true. I want to know what happened to you. The stars are all out and the night is so blue. Tell me a story and I'll tell mine to you. Sitting on the balcony, drinking up our wine, talking about the way that we used to live our lives. The words in the books, man, they're nothing but lines. I look into your eyes and you look into mine. You say, tell me a story, tell me true. I wanna know what happened to you. The stars are all out and the night is so blue. Tell me a story and I'll tell